You're listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast out of Wesley Seminary at Iwood. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Assistant Professor of Pastoral Care.
How should we think about politics? This is a topic that has huge consequences, and it is a topic that has very personal consequences as well. You're going to hear how that gets fleshed out in today's podcast episode. Joining me today is Dr. Hunter Baker. Dr. Baker is the author of Political Thought, A Student's Guide, which is a brief book published by Crossway Publications, that describes the role of political thought in the Christian intellectual tradition. In this book, he describes a number of political thinkers and also a number of Christian political thinkers and how they have deployed or critiqued political thought, and how these might be used as lenses for us to understand our world. Dr. Baker is a Juris Doctor, PhD, and he serves as the Dean of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. He's the author of a number of books, including The End of Secularism and The System Has a Soul. And as mentioned before, the book that we are discussing today is Political Thought, Student's Guide. Dr. Baker writes winsomely, he writes from within the Christian tradition, and he writes from his background of knowledge that includes law and political philosophy. Thanks for tuning into this episode, and enjoy. Well, Dr. Baker, let's just kick this off by asking, why is it important to have a working knowledge of political thought?
Well, the word that I would use is lordship. As in the lordship of Jesus Christ. Maybe another word would be stewardship. I remember being involved in campus ministry years ago and having somebody refer to a young man in the chapter as working through some lordship issues. And I was like, what does that mean, lordship issues? And it was explained to me, you know, that there were areas of the young man's life that he needed to bring under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And I was fascinated by that thought. I think that I've been kind of working through that ever since. And politics is one of those areas, right? Our politics is an area of life that is also under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And so we could talk about this on a lot of different levels. The most fundamental one is that we talk about justice all the time. We, you know, social justice, law and order type justice. One thing that fascinates me about Augustine is that Augustine says that the only just political community is one that acknowledges the kingship of Jesus Christ. So, you know, all the other justice is basically subordinate to that, right? That's the most fundamental issue of justice. And yet it's one that we really don't talk about or think about much at all. But on another level, you know, so that's maybe kind of an exalted idea of political thought, or certainly a very theological idea of political thought. You might also just think about that politics has to do with the way we live together in a community, but that is different from the other ways that we live together in a community. So most of the things we do, it's just sort of based on our voluntary cooperation, you know, that we make agreements with each other, we have relationships, and this drives the decisions that we make and the things that we do. But there is this one special area of the way we live together that is non-optional. You know, when we talk about politics and government, we need to understand that we're talking about something that ultimately is coercive. And so really it requires special attention. When we talk about politics, we're talking about what are the things ultimately that we have such a conviction about that we're going to make other people obey ultimately. And whether that comes down to jail time or financial penalties, or even the death penalty, that's the sort of the ultimate destination that thinking and talking about government drives us. And so it requires tremendous attention, tremendous thought, and deliberation. And so if we are going to get it right, we need to take seriously our stewardship of that issue.
One of the things that I really appreciated about the book, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, published by Crossway, and I think it's a nice corollary to what you've just described there, that we think about politics because the consequences are so big. And at the same time, we can think about politics because the practices are so personal and so small. So you start out the book by talking about the polity that happens within a family, how a family is run and can be run well or can be run poorly. So we have the implications of politics can be big, and the implications of politics can also be how do we have supper tonight, and how do we have good conversation around the table. Why did you think it was important to start with this family illustration in order to help arrest or engage our imaginations when we're thinking about politics?
Well, I did that because I think that I was thinking about people like my wife. I'm married to a female physician. She is very much sort of a person of science. She is not tremendously interested in politics and would not normally pay a lot of attention to politics. And I think I was trying to write something that would reach a person like her who just sort of compartmentalizes politics and, you know, okay, yeah, that's going on. I guess I better figure out who I'm going to vote for, but isn't really giving it a lot of deep thought or attention. And so I wanted to find some way to get that person's attention, right? To say, you may not realize it, but there's this really good kind of analogy for politics in your own life, and it has to do with families. And so if you can think about the kind of family that you grew up in, it may help you to kind of lock on to different ways of thinking about politics. And certainly people do have that experience, right? So I talked about the family that I grew up in, which had very wide boundaries of freedom, with sort of, you know, kind of an order from the top, but lots and lots of freedom. And if you didn't transgress the boundaries, then, you know, you wouldn't feel that imposition much, right? So you kind of had an incentive to stay within the boundaries, to abide by the norms. And then you have what we might call in a democracy, ordered liberty. But many other people grow up in a different kind of a family, where the family does everything together, right? And in a particular way. And so in my family, whereas, you know, sometimes we made it at the dinner table, sometimes we might eat in front of the TV, sometimes we might eat out in the backyard, sometimes we might skip the meal altogether. Other families may have a sacrosanct time, and everybody is going to be there, you know, every single time. And they understand that, right? And it could deal with the way you take vacations, or the way that the way the kids tackle homework, the way the family deals with its finances, the way the kids get money, all kinds of things. These things kind of derive from the order of the family, which is very similar to a political order. So that kind of helps people to understand. I think another reason that I thought about families goes back to Augustine again, because Augustine talks about the way we think about a term like peace. Everybody wants peace, right? We want to lead a peaceful life. But because our sin confuses our perception, we can mistake peace for the lack of conflict. And the lack of conflict can often be driven by the power that someone possesses. And so a lot of times we may say that we want peace, but actually what we want is our way, with no one generating a conflict with what we want. And so there's sort of a family analogy there also. If you imagine a family that is sort of well-ordered, you imagine a husband who respects his wife. They have a good dynamic together. We may have sort of the biblical idea of the family and the husband being the head of the family, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't respect his wife, consult his wife, count what she has to say in a very large way, that that would inform his judgment, that he would also care what the children think, that if they are wrong, he doesn't just sort of smash them down, but seeks to bring them about to a correct way of understanding. But we sort of see other kinds of families too, right? Where the father can almost be like a dictator or an autocrat, and abuses that godly authority and simply is going to have his way. And it doesn't matter what, right? And it doesn't, and then that may even involve violence. So that was another way to kind of, that I think I thought about the family when I thought about politics.
Well, it certainly brings it into concrete experience where people can see maybe even seasons where their homes had good politics, good ways of running, and then seasons where maybe the politics of the home were run by folly. So yeah. you talk about these different embedded practices or these ways of seeing politics within the closest context we have, which is our families. And then you've mentioned the big consequences that our politics can have as well. And kind of what's in my mind a little bit is, just as a person may grow up in a home and have certain political lenses about this is how a home should run, so can we have really large political lenses that are used not just to see our family, or not just through which we see our family, but through which we see our world. And so political philosophy can be these lenses that we look at the world and we see things either sharply or fuzzily, or we see, oh, that's how things should be, or maybe we see, oh, that's not how things should be, but it's already formed by a political philosophy. So to that end, I would like you to share, if you were to think of, let's say, two or three key political ideas that pastors and spiritual leaders in the West should have to understand their world, just to see, oh, that's why this is unfolding the way it is, or that's why we do this, right? If you were to have two or three political ideas that you would say, these are really important for you to see your world well in the West, what would they be?
Yeah, I think that three that I talked about in the book were order, liberty, and equality. So order is very fundamental to politics, right? I mean, the reason arguably that we have politics at all is because of our need for order. You know, sometimes some people who listen, they may have heard of sort of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And it begins with the fundamental needs like, you know, food and shelter. And then it kind of goes up until you get into kind of psychological needs like self-actualization and esteem and things like that. In politics, the most fundamental need is probably that need of order. and so our desire for order is really important. And it's also important for us to kind of figure out what we're willing to pay for that order, right? I talk about kind of the different social contract thinkers. And when I say social contract, I'm talking about the people who tried to kind of re-envision the origins of society, right? So to use two good examples, you could think about Thomas Hobbes, who is famous for the book Leviathan. And Hobbes kind of thought, so why do people live in political society? And in his imagination, you know, he thought about people in a state of nature. And he thought that nature is a terrifying place, you know, red in tooth and claw. And that life in the state of nature would be nasty, brutish, and short. And so in his mind, people come out of that state of nature in order to protect their lives. And if that is your reason for coming out of the state of nature, you know, simply to protect your existence, your life, then his idea was that you would give over to the political authority almost everything, right? That you would give the political authority the right to regulate your behavior, your speech, your religion, everything in order to maintain a safe environment in which to live. So that's a really dominant emphasis on order. another idea that I talked about was liberty. And so I could use another social contract thinker, which was John Locke. And John Locke imagined the state of nature differently. You know, he thought that in a state of nature, You know, it could be a little chaotic, but he thought human beings are still human beings in the state of nature. They're still created in the image of God. They're still potentially reasonable creatures, and they're still governed by the natural law. And so, so in his imagination, life in the state of nature would be perhaps a little disorderly. There wouldn't be a good way to protect against crime other than taking matters into your own hands and things like that. But so when he imagined why we would form a political society, it was to protect our liberty, to protect our freedom. Now, if you imagine coming together in a political society to protect your liberty, then that's a totally different thing than imagining that it will simply protect your safety, you know, provide basic order. And so, you know, he was willing to tolerate less from the government. He didn't feel that the government should be able to control your religion, for example, in that scenario. Really, all you're giving up to the government in that scenario is your right to be Batman, you know, to kind of be a vigilante, to vindicate your own cause. So, you know, you can see that's a much more limited sort of a political thought emphasizing liberty. And then another one would be Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who also imagined a social contract. And with his, the emphasis was on equality, because he thought that human beings were extremely equal in a state of nature. And he thought that civilization had basically worked to make us unequal. And so he wanted to find ways to recover that basic equality. But if you think about it, all of those are really important in the way we think about politics. Certainly, those of us who have grown up in the United States, we have a pretty strong sense of those three ideas working together. And maybe for us, the emphasis is on liberty. Maybe. I mean, a lot of people argue equality, but we don't have the Statue of Equality. We don't have the Equality Bell. We have the Statue of Liberty and the Liberty Bell. But, you know, in some other nations, equality might be the most predominant thought. Certainly it was in the more collectivist societies. And in some societies, order has been most predominant. And I would argue that in China right now, order is the governing thought.
So you've touched on how there are different approaches to conceptualizing what is the political good, right? Should we be aiming at liberty? Should we be aiming at equality? Should we be aiming at security and order, right? What's the most important thing? And somebody might say, well, it depends, right? It kind of depends on the time that we're in. Maybe it depends on various factors. Maybe if they go back to the home, they're going to say, mom or dad need to be in charge clearly at certain times. Whereas at other times, it might be okay for mom or dad to account for the children's opinions on things, right? There might be some more freedom, or other times there might be more order, right? They can think back to the home and say, well, it depends on which should be important. I don't want to delve into which you think is the most important right now, right? People can buy the book and maybe get a sense of what you think is appropriate at this time, or what needs to be defended, or what needs to be lifted up. What I'd be curious to hear, though, is we've got pastors and spiritual leaders listening in, and part of what they're trying to do, not just in the U.S., but also in Canada and other places around the world that are listening in, is they're trying to form churches. They're trying to form other or, you know, communities, places of that have common objects of love, right? United by their love for God and the love of God for them, that they are recognizing and that they're trying to live out and be to whom they're trying to be loyal. How might you suggest the pastor, who's the leader of the church, how can they help their people to who undoubtedly will appreciate one of these three, and maybe even more, but let's say one of these three factors more than others, how can they help these communities to gel well together and to learn to be a community while they might have values that are not that are at least distinct and maybe even in tension with one another from time to time?
Well, those of us who live in the West, we typically have the right to participate in politics and the right to vote. So this is something to be stewarded, right? This is something to think carefully about how we use it. And so if we're going to use it properly, you know, that little bit of the sovereignty that we possess, that we contribute, then we need to understand it to do that well. And so I would argue that all three of these are very important in that sense, right? And so when we think about the Bible and government, I think that sort of the fundamental purpose of government is kind of the way Martin Luther thought of it, which is that it is a ministry provided to us from God to protect people from the worst effects of sin, right? That the government is there to punish and restrain evil men, to coerce, restrain, and punish evil men, so that sort of their predatory desires don't overtake the whole world. So that's sort of fundamental, and that speaks to order, right? but I think also that the Bible tells us that we are made in the image of God. And, you know, not only do we get that from the Bible, but some of the classical thinkers like Cicero talk about that human beings are part of the, basically we call it the family of reason, that we alone possess this sort of ability to think and contemplate and reflect in the same way that we understand that God does. And that speaks to liberty, right? That we have this nature that is capable of giving and receiving reasons, and to be able to participate in the making of decisions. You know, that sort of speaks to, well, really both to liberty and equality, if you think about it. And it's important also that the government doesn't take this may be the most important thing for pastors to get, that the government doesn't get everything, right? You know, that we might think, I can't remember if I mentioned this in the book or if I've been talking about this more lately, but the sort of the story of when Christ is asked about paying taxes to Caesar, right? And he contemplates the coin, right? And we think about the whose image is on the coin, Caesar, right? And he says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And so I think a lot of times people focus on that and they focus on the Caesar part of that statement. But I focus on the other part, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, right? Well, the image of Caesar is on the coin, but whose image is on us? God's image, right? That there is a place for Caesar, right? You know, there is a place for government, but it doesn't get everything. And it's never above God's own claims upon us. And so maybe understanding that is the most important thing that pastors and spiritual leaders should understand.
I'm also thinking about one of the values, and this is one of the things that comes through in a really readable way in the book, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, which you've written, published by Crossway, is that these different inclinations that we have, a desire to be free and to have a measure of autonomy, desires to have order so that things are not chaotic, desire for there to be justice, right? Like a proper structure and ordering of things. That because these ideas have histories, one of the ways that we can help people gel together while they might have different values is to show some of the history that they come from. And that both strengthens, but also gives a critique. History helps us to see how these ideas have been deployed well, and it also shows us how these ideas have been deployed poorly. One of the things I think it really is an opportunity for pastors is a sense of history in order to both validate and to chasten, right? To validate, to say, this is where this idea has been used well, this is how it's fit into the Christian tradition, and this is what the Christian tradition has had to say in warning against it. So I really, I appreciated the way that your book was able to flesh out some of those ideas and give us pointers to where we might go for even more research or reflection on them, and couched in the value of the Christian tradition. We're going to pause for a moment, hear a word from one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back to talk with Dr. Hunter Baker just a little bit more.
Hi, my name is Tenley Horner, and I am Wesley.
Hi, I'm David Rosenthal, and I am Wesley.
Hi, I'm Yvette McCracken-Ursary,
And I am Wesley.
So, Dr. Baker, through the book, you've talked about historical figures. You mentioned St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas. You've gone through political thinkers, and you've, a few you've mentioned here, John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. But towards the end, you also bring up Martin Luther King Jr., specifically his letters from a Birmingham jail. Talk to us about why you included Martin Luther King Jr. and the importance he is for a voice in forming political thought today.
Yeah, you know, it just occurred to me that in the book, I talked about both of the Martin Luthers, Martin Luther and Martin Luther King Jr., both incredibly consequential individuals. Letter from Birmingham Jail is something that I would encourage everybody who listens to this podcast to go and read. You know, it's not that long. I have assigned it to students many, many, many times. Sometimes I call it the sort of the cherry on top of the Western political tradition, because it does such a wonderful job of thinking in Christian terms about politics, and in such a way that it brings a lot of things together. So for instance, one of the things that, you know, obviously Martin Luther King Jr. was crusading against segregation and institutionalized racism. So one of the things that he says, he reminds us, right, you know, in a very conformist age, he reminded us what Augustine and Aquinas both said, which is an unjust law is no law at all, right? In other words, that law in and of itself, God gives us law. In and of itself, law partakes of justice. Law is constituted by justice. And so if a law is adverse to justice, then it cannot truly be a law. Then it's simply the will of some men and women or something like that, but it doesn't really deserve the lofty title of law. That's really important. Another thing that he also talks about the importance of civil disobedience, and he talks about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as examples, but also Socrates. but one of the really great things, he gives this wonderful sort of word picture about what sort of a role the church should play in the political society. And he says, the church should not be a thermometer, it should be a thermostat, right? A thermostat, so not something that merely records the temperature, which sometimes the church is tempted to be. We simply just say whatever the consensus of the society is, And that's all we have to say. We should be a thermostat. In other words, that we actually seek to influence the environment, to bring the environment to a particular temperature of holiness, of godliness. And I think that those are brilliant sentiments that we should spread as far in the church as we can.
Dr. Baker, thanks so much for tuning in and bringing us some of your reflections and information today and sharing with our listeners the importance of the history of political thought and how it's been used in the Christian tradition and how the Christian tradition has spoken into this as well. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, as well for tuning in. We appreciate you tuning in and listening to the topics and resources that we are bringing you for Fruitful Ministry. Thanks so much to Cam Davis for his production work and editing work. Listeners, you'd do us a great favor if you would like and subscribe, upvote us on whatever platform you use to access the Wesley Seminary podcast, help other people hear about the topics and resources from this podcast. A couple of episodes that might be of interest would be from Vincent Bacot of Wheaton College. Another episode on the political disciple may be valuable, and an episode with Sarah Rudin, where she talks about St. Augustine and a recent translation of his classic Confessions. Those might be a couple of other episodes that may interest you as you check out the other resources available through the Wesley Seminary podcast. So thanks so much for tuning in. Thank you, Dr. Baker. Hope you all have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.